Would you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Denny Tedesco, and I am the director of The Wrecking Crew.
But you've been working on this film for how many years?
19 years. It started in 1996.
You had a little bit of motivation for making this film, but before we get there, what was your, aside from the fact that you just happened to have your dad, which we're certainly going to talk about, what was your background in filmmaking and music and all of the other things that it takes to make a film at this level? Because, you know, it's not like you said, oh, I want to dedicate something to my dad. You had other experience and then some.
Yeah, I mean, I started in filmmaking. I was a decorator when I came out of college, not because I was a decorator, quote unquote. I wasn't artistic. I just happened to take a job. I was in film school. So it was Eating Raoul was my first film. Stayed in art department for a few years, but my goal was to write. I was going to college to write. And then I got into gripping and lighting and came out of college and doing that on a lot of rock videos. So that kind of gave me an idea about, you know, filmmaking there, and did some features as a technician, but I still wanted to write. But then after a while, I realized I'm not a writer. You know, a writer writes every day. So at a certain point, you kind of get lost what you want to do. But I kept going, and then around in early 90s, I started doing IMAX films, working on IMAX films as a technician, and that was fun. Got to travel the world, but still confused, you know, what I was going to do when I grow up. And then in 96, my father, Tommy Tedesco, was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And Dad was a session musician in Los Angeles, did a lot of the rock and roll in the 60s, and then went on to do many, over 1,000 films.
You got an amazing amount of experience and being around people that gave you the opportunity that when it came time to make this, your skill set with all the things, because a documentary is different than making, it's a narrative, you're telling a story, so you are writing without writing, but it's really knowing how to put a zillion elements together and being in the art department, as an example, I see a complete parallel line there.
No, it's funny you said that because at that point, you're right. Is playing so many different roles when you're working and understanding what everybody does, you're able to pull from all your friends, you're able to understand what you're supposed to do. In documentaries, it's listening and understanding and listening. There's one thing, it's funny because there was a point years after, you know, when I was trying to pitch this film and I had some, you know, nice tape that I was pitching in England, and this one company said, we'll love to do it, but we'll have to get another director because you don't have any experience directing. And I went, well, you know what?
This is the story I have to tell.
Yeah, and my feeling was, why am I going to educate this guy?
It would take the amount of time it would take to fill that person's head with not only the gestalt, but the actual physical information.
And there were things also, I knew where the skeletons lied. You know, I knew where everybody, you know, the good and the bad and the ugly. You know, there's some emotional things that maybe they might not give that other person. So I said no, and not that it was going to be made then, but I just kept going.
Atypical childhood. Being the son of somebody who obviously day and night was out there playing. When did you realize, what age did you suddenly go, my dad's not an accountant?
Oh, that's funny, because the kid across the street, his dad was an accountant.
Always.
It's funny you said that, because I always remember as a kid going, God, he's lucky his dad's an accountant.
he's got a legit, I know exactly. His dad has got a reliable, legitimate job, and they know where the money's coming from.
Well, fortunately for me, dad was working all the time.
You had the dad who happened to be a rarity.
I was in the era, as I like to remind my family, when I was born in 61, that's when dad was really kicking butt and really doing well. But the thing is, dad went to work. I didn't know dad I only knew dad went to work. It wasn't like dad was a musician that went to work. I knew he went to work as a musician, but it never comprehended to me until 71, 72, when friends said, hey, your dad's on the Partridge Family album. And I go, oh, okay. Now, I knew he did all those albums with, you know, Beach Boys. I knew it, but it doesn't comprehend when you're a kid.
No, and also what's really strange about music, unless it's the Beatles, unless it's a few rare things, while it's happening, is not as important as sometimes after it's happened and looking back on it, right?
Absolutely. Exactly. Here's one thing is, Dad went to work. I never saw my father bring a guitar home. They were in the guitars were in his car. So instead of a hammer, a saw, a drill, whatever
briefcase,
the other, yeah,
like
right.
Work,
he didn't.
Yeah.
He had the classical guitar, the 12 string, the mandolin, the banjo, and an amp, and a Telecaster in the car. So I never saw my father play because he didn't need to play at home. He didn't have to practice. So I didn't have that, that understanding of what a musician had to do. You know, and it wasn't until later did I really understand it when he started playing on his own in the 70s for his own jazz album.
Dad came home. You said, was the dinner table. Oh, by the way, I played the blah, blah, blah session today.
No, it's so funny because it sounds like because it wasn't that special for him. When he went to work, you know, unless it was Sinatra, you know, he was working with everybody, but Dad just went to work and recorded. Sometimes he didn't know who he recorded for that day because he was just laying down tracks and maybe they'll put the vocal on later. But he wasn't recording hits. He was recording songs that became hits.
Isn't that phenomenal, though? What an interesting perspective, because when you look back on it, right, everybody would assume that your dad came home and said, you know what, I was just on this song called I Think I Love You, and I have to tell you, this song is going to be huge. And there was none of that discussion.
No. No, because it was literally, he had 3 hours at work. Let's say a session was 3 hours. He would go to work, you do 3 or 4 songs, you move on, go to another session, move on. If he did 3 to 4 sessions a day, that's maybe 10, 12, 15 pieces of music he was thrown at him.
So much for the glamour of the industry.
Yeah, I mean, there's those moments where he felt like, oh, yeah, that was fun because he got something to play that day. You know, sometimes it was, you know, just chunka, chunka, chunka. You know, and, you know, rhythm, and that was it. Or it was some, maybe a lead on, like, the Marquettes or those songs, those surf bands. You know, they were pretend surf bands. And he was the one that was playing for the Routers and the Marquettes and the T-Bones. These are pretend groups that were studio groups.
Well, yeah, they were all set, exactly. And I talk about that all the time. There were so many.
You know, someone asked, you know, yeah, but it's like Hal Blaine. The drummer, how many, I think he replaced like 75 drummers in all these bands. I mean, it was just what they did. It wasn't, it was a business. Listen, the record business was there. They didn't trust rock and roll in at the beginning. They really didn't know if it was going to make money for them. So if they're going to put a group into, let's say they're going to take a chance, let's say, with the association. Well, the producer had that choice. I don't want to go in there with these guys. I feel better if I have my guys in there and let, you know, the group sing over it. Or, better yet, let's talk about Mr. Tambourine Man, the Byrds. Now, they can play, right? But Terry Melcher, who is the producer, he says, guys, I'm going to let you, I'll have Roger McGuinn sing, and I'll let him be play the 12 string, but I'm bringing my guys in. And he brings in Leon Russell on piano, Larry Nechtel on bass, Hal Blaine on drums, Jerry Cole and Bill Pittman on guitars. Now, the Byrds are furious. They don't even show up for this recording. But as Roger McGuinn said, we did the A side and the B side in 3 hour session. When we did Turn, Turn, Turn with the group, it was 77 takes. But Terry Melcher, don't forget, his job as a producer, come in, I got to get a hit, then we can make an album. If we do well, we move on to the next step. And we'll try our best.
So, armed with this information, when one watches the film, 19 years ago, what was it? Was it a dedication to your dad and wanting the story to get out there? Because I don't think so. I think it was more that as someone who does what you do, you said there's a really great story to be told here that nobody, if I don't tell it, nobody's ever going to be able to tell it in that level of reality.
That's funny you said that because it's exactly true. The diagnosis of terminal cancer was a huge thing when they said, you know, he had a year to live. And I knew that story always wanted that story to be done, and I always wanted to do it.
Wow, so all of this footage that we see in the film of him talking with the cronies, right. That was between when he was diagnosed?
Yeah.
Wow, that's incredible. I didn't know that. That's incredible.
That roundtable discussion is basically 96. It's funny because I did do another session with him one-on-one, but it was about a year later. It was 6 months before he passed. It just wasn't, you know, it wasn't him.
The same energy. Yeah,
the energy was, and it's hard because it's just like, you know what? And it didn't want to do it. But what's interesting, though, is when we cut 30 minutes, we started cutting in 2006. And because at that point, no one was helping us. And my wife and I, you know, my wife was concerned we made the most expensive home movie. And we figured, you know, it was like we just kept refinancing and just kept, you know, using credit cards. So at that point we thought, if we don't do it, we're done. We just wasted 10 years. But we cut this 30-minute piece, or just cut 30 minutes, and a friend who was a director, producer, or editor said, why are you cutting it like this? He says, this is a history documentary. I said, what do you mean? He says, why did you do it? He says, you're not telling us, you're a director, but you're not giving us the insight of what you know. And what he's trying to do is pull me into it. He said, you got something we can't give. And I was very reluctant because I wanted to almost be invisible as the director. I want to be the director, quotes on the sides. I wanted to separate myself, but I realized, you know what? To tell this story, I can't separate myself. I'm lying if I did.
What you did, which would be the opposite of what anybody would expect you would do, is it's not a tale about your dad.
No, and that was the thing, is once it was the story, once we go in between my father and the group of session musicians, like, well, you know, how do we decide who's going to be part of it? Part of it was because we were doing it on our own, I could only tell the story of a few, you know, the other because I couldn't afford to do more. And then what we ended up doing is we got to a point where, all right, well, this is the story of about my father and his extended family, the Wrecking Crew.
Right.
Once we told that, we were off and running.
But the musicians who have lived to see this, the Howls, the Carols, that's a good thing, because at least they've gotten to see their lives on the screen, because they probably have never stepped back and said, and because what you're describing about it not being a factory per se, but the fact that you went in very much like the most talented plumber in the Western world and went in and did your thing, to then look back and say, oh my gosh, I really played bass on that, or I really played guitar, or in Howell's case, oh my gosh, I played drums on, I'm sure you probably know the number. How many number one hits did Hal Blaine play drums on? By doing this, you've also given some of these people some amazing recognition.
You know, in the film, there's a point where Hal says, you know what, we were at the right place at the right time, meaning, you know, when they came in, because they came in the early 60s, and the reason they were so important because the older guys didn't want to play that rock and roll.
They would not play rock and roll.
It was for a couple reasons. One, they could have been demo sessions, which maybe were, you know, lower rate or illegal for the union. So these older guys, I could take a chance.
Right.
But guys like Hal, my father, and Carol, and all these others, they're going to take a chance because they're breaking in.
Yeah, so what do they have to lose?
They got nothing. You know, they're working. So once they got established, but then in the late 60s, it was a time period, and all of a sudden, the ones that went on, like Hal, went on to do more recordings and records, but then went on John Denver tour. My father went into film and TV. Carol went into teaching. You know, so everybody goes in a different world. But what he said was, we were at the right place at the right time. And I realized, for me, I was at the right place at the right time. I was able to do this, start telling the story in 96. If I had to tell it now, it's not going to work. Because at 84 years old, you ask a question to someone that's 84 versus 64, it's difficult.
Yeah, you caught them just at that age where they were still lively and still excited and could really...
And their memories are obviously great, but they're also, they're willing to talk about things because they're kind of away from it now. You got to step away to tell the truth sometimes.
Yep.
You know, if you're in the middle of it, you got to maybe hold back a little. You know, you're still thinking, you're still working, you got to watch what you say.
where session musicians did land up, and they do to this day, is on soundtracks. So what were some of the soundtracks that he played on that were really iconic?
Oh, my dad?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he was doing like Bonanza. In the early days, it was Bonanza. He was Batman was the lead guitar in that. It was also Green Acres.
Oh, really? That can't be more iconic than that.
And that was one of the few sessions as a child I remember going to, because I only remember as I was there for... We were taking Dad to work, then we were going on vacation. I just remember Vic Mizzi, the great composer, conducting. And it was the funniest thing to see a grown man throw his hips and arms around. I didn't know what he was doing. But then, you know, later it was, as he said, the god-awful wah-wah on Three's Company. Do-do-do-wow-wow-wow-wow-wow. It's like, you know, those are those things where that's what you do. You go to work.
That's where session musicians went once bands started being self-sufficient, right?
Yeah, and the thing is, there was also only certain session musicians can go there, because Dad had a reputation of being an unbelievable reader. John Williams said about him, he says, you know, when I get to the point where I do my music, it's all about my music. And he says, you can only hope the musician's going to get 75%. But with Tommy, it was 110%. So he's really bringing the most out of it. That's when you know. When my father got to that point where they said, what do you want to be remembered for? He says, you know, any one of those guys, when we were doing the rock stuff, anybody could do that. I mean, there was 12 guys that could have done that. But I want to be remembered for the work I did in the movies. When you got John Williams or James Horner holding a week or 2 weeks in a month, 6 months ahead, and say, I have a movie coming up and it's written for guitar. And you know they're asking Tommy. They're not holding for a guitar chair. It's just Tommy they want.
But let's talk Cutting Room Floor, and let's talk about some of the songs that are on the soundtrack for starters. And let's start there. Did you purposely select the hits, or did you throw in some things that people will go, whoa, I had no idea?
Well, that's a good thing. Yeah, it's funny, because that was the other thing, is when we were making this film and couldn't get it financed, and people would say, who hadn't seen the film or even before it was cut, they were saying, why don't you get less songs? You know, bring it down to 20. And I said, you can't. I said, if I told you right now, if I said...
How would you select?
If I give you Frank Sinatra, The Birds, Mamas and Papas, Fifth Dimension, Sam Cooke and the Chipmunks. What do you got?
And add Herb Alpert to the mix.
Herb Alpert, Do You Want to Rest? I mean, that was the thing, is you had to basically show quantity. And I always say, not always quality. You know, LA was a factory town, and I don't mean that as a disrespect. Look, Tambourine Man, 3 hours, right? Probably less than that, because they had A and a B side.